You're working right there. You get the bass in your.
It's got the bass there.
I love it.
I was just working. I had some ideas, and you know, it's like playing an instrument. You play an instrument, right?
Yep, guitar. Yep. Yeah.
So you know, it's like you. So it's like that, in moment of enlightenment when you're like playing the same thing over and over, and then you just go like one fret up or down or string up or down, and you go, wow, I can do this.
Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford. The Rudy Sargent.
Hi there. This is Steve Hackett.
You folks are just recommend a triumph from a talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Rudy Sarzo is back with us, a friend of the show, of course. We love talking with Rudy, always doing so many exciting things. Just had the bass there, working on some music, some ideas there. Rudy, back in Quiet Riot, of course, you know the news by now, and there's a lot of news. Rudy, this is, when we heard this, I just thought, man, oh man, this is so great. I mean, obviously, you know, we all miss Kevin, we all miss Frankie, of course, you know, rest in peace to them, you know, but to see some, you know, I don't want to say continuity, but the, you know, a veteran coming back to the fold like that, how does it feel to you to be back?
How does it feel? Well, at this moment, I feel like I am ready to not only take action as far as celebrating the memory of our band members that have passed on, Frankie Benelli, Kevin DeBrow, Randy Rhodes, you know. And it's really interesting for me about, you know, of course, with Frankie and Kevin, we all celebrated Randy Rhodes' memory while we played together in Quiet Riot. As a matter of fact, the first album, Mental Health, is dedicated to Randy. The song Thunderbird is a song that that Kevin wrote for Randy when Randy left the band to join Ozzy. And then later on, there's a story attached to it, but just in a nutshell, Frankie, Carlos, Kevin, and myself, we recorded that song as a tribute to Randy's memory for what became the Mental Health record. So we always celebrate the legacy and the memory of our those that have passed on within Quiet Riot, within the show. As a matter of fact, when Frankie was with us, he would always have like a moment during the show. And I'm actually doing the same thing. I right before Thunderbird, I say a few words to the audience, you know, to give them a sense of what they're about to hear. It's not just another song.
Yeah.
Rudy, what? Dave and I went crazy. We saw the, you know, the posts, and then the first live show with video and pictures of yourself up on stage for the first time with them in a long time. Yeah. How cool was that to finally be back? You know where it all began.
Yeah, you know it's really. because I've been doing some, you know, interviews and people ask me about, you know, being back in Quiet Riot. And the best way I can describe it is it's a consciousness. It's a consciousness, a belief system. I know consciousness sounds a little vague, but it's really a belief system. When I first joined Quiet Riot, I found the band that collectively everybody believed in the same thing. Not only where are we going, how are we going to get there, and also our taste in music. And our presentation, you know, and that is something that I even experienced once the band ceased to exist when Randy left Quiet Riot. It ceased to exist when Randy left to join Ozzy. And then later I joined Ozzy. I found that consciousness again with Randy. You know, I mean, if you look at the Blizzard of Oz, you know, when Tommy Aldridge and I were there, the band Blizzard of Oz, Ozzy's band, you know, you have two guys from Quiet Riot, at each side of Ozzy. And which is ironic because just a couple of years or 3 years before that, we were being totally neglected by the local music industry in Los Angeles. And then all of a sudden, we're on this, you know, part of this group. Randy had recorded those two incredible records, Blizzard and Diary of a Madman. And I mean, of course, you know, there's certain dynamics that happened that were different. You know, Randy found himself in a different situation once he started playing with Ozzy, because now Ozzy has the record deal. And Ozzy told him, you know, just write where it comes natural to you. Whereas when Randy was in Quiet Riot, we were just trying to please the labels, the record labels. So we were in a little box, and this really freed Randy musically to take, you know, to explore and to become the Randy that everybody knows today, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Randy Rhoads, rather than the local guitar hero. And yeah, I was in the Randy Rhoads era from 78 to 79. And then that's when Randy left to join Ozzy. And then I started playing with him and Ozzy later on in 81. And then by 82, I was again in a Quiet Riot that we call the Metal Health version of Quiet Riot. And that one, we're celebrating 40 years of the making of Metal Health record this year. We're celebrating that. And that had its own story behind it, its own trajectory, how it happened. You know, I mean, there's so many little things that fell into place that that it made the record Metal Health what it is, you know, and which that was, you know, we had that record master with a release date, and we could not get a manager. We could not get any support from the local industry in LA, because they thought, hey, this is not going to go anywhere. This is dinosaur. Yeah. Dinosaur. But there was a sequence of events that happened, that because we never gave up on it, you know, because I kept telling the guys, listen, you know, there's it's happening out there. Just because it's not happening in LA doesn't mean that there is no Def Leppard and no Iron Maiden and no Saxon or no Motorhead. These are bands that I already have been on tour with Ozzy. I knew what was going on out there. And at that moment, due to the lack of you know, there was no social media. There was no awareness what was happening in the rest of the world, like we have today, that, you know, in LA was just whatever's happening in LA locally, that's what's happening. And that's what was getting signed by the major labels. And that's where the focus and the attention and the support, financial support from the labels went to. We were like, okay, you guys made a record. Good luck. See ya. You know, and it was a series of events. You know, one of them was the US Festival. We wound up doing, we got called in to do the US Festival. We were offered the US Festival 2 days before it happened. We had just been a support, you know, we got an agency out of Detroit that also represented the Scorpions, and the Scorpions were doing a short tour, about 2.5 weeks or so, to warm up for the US Festival, because they had been in the studio recording. They had not been on the road. So this was kind of like the warm up to one show, the US Festival, which I personally had no idea what that was. No idea, right? Okay. No idea about it. Okay. So we finished the tour in Denver, and Barry Fay, who was the big local promoter in Denver, Fayline was his company. Mm. He had just moved Joel Walsh from the metal day to the Bowie, Stevie Nicks, you know, more pop day, which was the following day. So that left a band in there to fill the spot, the gap. So he catches our show with the Scorpions, and he comes backstage right after we finished playing, and he offers us the spot. And our manager was traveling with us. He knew the importance of that show. We had no idea. So he made it, you know, he made some calls, some decisions, and we made it happen. Then you get up on stage in front of 350,000 people and do basically the same Quiet Riot show you know how to do, whether you're playing in a club or opening up for the Scorpions. And it carries on. You know, I mean, it carries into the audience. They get it. So that kind of like started our ascend towards number one, you know. Yeah. And then we were able to get on tours opening up for ZZ Top, Loverboy, Iron Maiden, Black Sabbath. And by the time we were with Black Sabbath, we hit number one in November, thanks to MTV, which was another piece in the puzzle for us. And MTV would play Come On Feel the Noise every half hour.
Yeah.
You know, oh, and there was no better marketing tool than that.
So when you hit number one, I mean, what are you thinking? What, it's just exhilaration? I mean, I don't know what the word would be.
Yeah, it was like a momentary exhilaration because I was thinking ahead. You know, when we got to number one, I'm thinking about, okay, headlining. Now we're headlining. Because, you know, I've been through basically that same ride to the top with Ozzy about a year before. We're talking 1983. And in 81, I joined Ozzy, and it was that's sort of like, you know, okay, Ozzy is trying to establish himself, touring solo, Ozzy Osbourne band. We got Randy, we got Tommy, and then later on we added Don Airey on keyboards, and it's like, okay. And I saw that. And when you do that, you look at the landscape and you recognize and you go, okay, this is how it's done, right?
Yeah.
Then I got in with Quiet Riot, and we were climbing the same mountain, and I can go, oh, I've seen this before. Okay, so it means that the record's gonna explode. We're ready to hit on MTV. Next stop is headlining. So I was thinking about headlining already, becoming a headlining band. It's a whole different presentation. When you're an opening band, you don't have the production. So now what are we gonna do live that is different from all the other bands? You know, and at the core of it is always the band, you know. It's like all my favorite bands from the 70s, they just needed a couple of follow spots and some lights so you could see their faces. But it was all about the energy of the band, which always Quiet Riot had, that energy. We wrote music that was a soundtrack to that energy, so we could perform with that energy on stage, you know. And so that's where my focus was. Yes, it was like, yeah, we're number one. Okay. There's more to be done here.
Oh, not to get political, but got to ask you, because you came from where you came from.
Yeah.
Communism was a factor. And
Still is.
obviously. And what are your thoughts just right now with kids coming out of this pandemic? We're on the verge of possibly, who knows, World War III maybe. A sovereign nation was just attacked and it's still being attacked, brutalized. Any thoughts from your end of things?
Yeah. You're asking a person who was alive and old enough to experience the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. Now, the Bay of Pigs, I don't know if you have any background about that. You probably do. Came to a halt. The actual plan, the Bay of Pigs invasion, actually had the support of the U.S. Navy at the time, until Khrushchev called Kennedy and said, if American soldiers enter Cuban soil, you're starting World War III. Mm. Okay, so that's why it was such a failure, because the plan, the full plan, was not put into place. Mm-hmm. Because what happened is, the Navy held back and said, okay, we're not going in. We're not going in. We're not going to land in Cuba. But the Cuban soldiers that had been trained, they went on. They say, okay, we've come this far. We're going to do this on their own, right? And that's why it was such a failure, because they were, you know, overtaken by the whole Cuban army that was waiting for them. Okay. That's phase one. So I was still in Cuba during that time. In the middle of it, my family, on September 1st, 1961, we leave Cuba and we come to the United States. Shortly thereafter, while I was living in Miami, I experienced the missile crisis. Right? Now, the missile crisis meant that now the Russians had nuclear missiles 90 miles away from Cuba. Mm. right? You know what it feels like?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what it feels like? You know what it feels like to stand on Flagler Street and watch the soldiers coming down, you know, like tanks, jeeps, whatever, going down towards Key West, towards the most southern point of Florida, just prepared, right, for any attack. That's, you know, as a child, and to experience that, it can be a little rattling to you, but it's also, you know, something that is beyond your control. You just look at it and you go, okay, and you just basically pray to God that nothing's going to happen, everything's going to be okay, and but be prepared for anything. You know, so right now we're going through this, and I hope that so many of us make the effort within ourselves to avoid it. Okay, yeah. This might sound really, really weird, but if we're talking about consciousness, we live in the world that we create. We, as collectively, as humanity, you know, we are, our energy can only expand outside of our bodies within 6 feet radius, right? But if collectively we can create the consciousness and believe that very soon this will come to an end and humanity will continue without the dangers of becoming a totalitarian world, but still living in freedom. If we believe that and not necessarily provoke the other side to go to do the unthinkable, I believe that we'll get out of this phase. But, you know, some people do it with prayer. Some people do it with constant consciousness of, like, I watch the news and I say, you know what? We're getting closer to the end of this nightmare. And we're gonna survive it. I think we can do that as humanity.
Yeah.
Because to be honest with you, if you provoke a madman, that will do. There's this old cliche: do not argue with a drunk or a crazy person. They're not gonna reason.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason for what he's doing, at all. He's mad, and you have to treat mentally ill leaders. You can't really provoke them. You have to, like, treat them differently and stop them as soon as you can. But it has to be an educated way of doing it. I am not a military person. I don't know about military strategy. I'm not even a politician. I'm a musician. We are each other's alternative realities. This is the way I believe. We can be anything.
Yeah.
I could have one day say, you know what? I'm going to be a military strategist. And do no, I'm the bass player. This is how I connect. this was inside of me. I'm a musician, you know?
Yeah.
And many things that are in addition to that, but it's all part of who I am, you know, as a complete being like yourself, you know, Shane, you know? And if we do that, if we can just, like, consciously think about this war is not part of our story,
right,
of our consciousness, it will come to end. It really will. Because the people in charge who are thinking alike, you know, I'm talking about the military and the politicians and so on, the world leaders, if they also have that consciousness, they'll make it happen.
Makes you wonder. I've been sort of, for another podcast project, zooming with people on the ground, Ukrainian soldiers in Kyiv, and some people in parliament there, and you know, they've talked about the disillusioned state of some of these soldiers, the Russian soldiers, you know, who I think have just, they're like, why are we doing this? You know, they're like, deserting and walking away. And if there's more of that, you know, then that could be that break. I mean, like, what?
Yes.
You know, this is strength in numbers.
Yeah.
Enough of them rise up, or at least just say, no, we're not doing this. I mean, it could save the world, or it was, you know,
And
it's like, it's just powerful to think about.
It's really ironic, you know, when you think about, let's say, a cliche, but it's a cliche because it made an impact.
Sure.
Napoleon, Waterloo.
Mm.
It's the same thing, you know, Napoleon, but it's in reverse. Napoleon went to actually attack Russia, right? And the same thing happened. They just worn him out. Of course, we're talking about nuclear power now. It's completely different. It's like if he's got his back against the wall and it's like, my soldiers are defecting, this whole thing is falling apart. Okay, if I'm gonna go, I'm taking everybody, the whole world with me, boom. And that's what must be avoided at all costs, to put a madman with his back against the wall because he will do the unthinkable. And there's plenty of sources throughout history to back that up.
Yeah. And Shane, you've talked about the checking of power. You know, you were talking about that the other day.
Yeah. You know, did you guys get to play Ukraine a lot?
Yes, I did. With Dio, okay. Belarus, Ukraine.
Beautiful people.
You know, there's some interesting things going on during the Soviet, you know, the Soviet, you know, era. Now we're basically entering the same era under a different logo or flag or whatever. But, you know, I played there. And what I really found interesting was once you went into Poland, and this is, we traveled from Belarus by train to Poland, at the border, the tracks change, different track size. So I wake up and I'm going like, what's that banging going on? You know, I'm in the train, in sleeper train. And I look out the little window of my train, you know, the little room that I'm in, compartment. And I see all these different carts having their wheels change, taking them off and then putting back on the tracks again, because Russia and all the border countries had different tracks. So when they get to the track, it wasn't like you could hijack a Russian train and take it to another European country, or have a European army come in to attack Russia. It was really interesting.
It's something. It's scary. I mean, you know, it's as if a pandemic isn't enough for the world, right?
I know.
Yeah.
I know, but you know, I think we're going to be okay. I'm beginning to get a sense of like, okay, we're nearing the end, and it's not going to be the end of the world. I think that there's enough consciousness, even from within, that will crumble it quicker than anything else. If the consciousness from within, the belief system of the Russian people, not the government, not the militaries, the belief system of the Russian people is such that they believe that this is wrong, it will stop.
Yeah.
I think
it will come from within, you know. I think that'll be his demise, because leaders like this never ends well for them.
Yeah.
I mean, history shows that.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what Time Magazine, the cover, The Return of History. It was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and so many parallels, so many frequencies to that, you know, so many.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. But I mean, I'm 71 years old, and I gotta tell you, aside from experiencing communism in my country of birth and certain other events in my life, you know, global world events, compared to either living during World War I or World War II, I had it pretty easy.
Yeah.
My generation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The baby boomers. Yeah.
Yeah.